ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Thursday, the 8th of January. I'm David Lipson in Canberra, coming to you from Ngunnawal country and acknowledging other custodians. The United States has boarded and seized a Russian-flagged ship in the North Atlantic Ocean, which America claims is linked to Venezuelan oil. It's one of two Venezuela-linked oil tankers intercepted by the US Coast Guard within hours of each other. 4 days after the capture of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro by the US military, there are still huge questions over the country's future. Correspondent Ben Knight reports from Washington.
Good morning and Happy New Year, everybody.
In wintry Washington this morning, White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt held her first briefing of the year.
And I know there is a lot of news out there today.
Not surprisingly, Venezuela was at the top of the agenda.
The president is fully deploying his peace through strength foreign policy agenda. So we're continuing to be in close coordination with the interim authorities. And their decisions are going to continue to be dictated by the United States of America.
So, will one of those directives be to release the political prisoners held in Venezuela by the former regime?
That's not a question that I've personally spoken about to the president with, so I will let him answer that question. I don't want to make new policy at this podium today.
When it comes to the question of Venezuela's oil, there is clarity. The country has a stockpile of at least 30 million barrels of oil that can't be sold because of sanctions. Well, the US will now sell it on the international market. Previously, the White House had said the proceeds of those sales would go to help the people of Venezuela. But today, there was a small but important change to that policy. The White House says the US will now get a cut of that money too.
All proceeds from the sale of Venezuelan crude oil and products will first settle in US-controlled accounts at globally recognized banks to guarantee the legitimacy and integrity of the ultimate distribution of proceeds, and those funds will be dispersed for the benefit of the American people and the Venezuelan people at the discretion of the United States government.
The White House will hold meetings with oil executives this week. But there's still no timetable for elections in Venezuela. The ABC, like all foreign media, is banned from entering Venezuela. And that's a rule that hasn't changed under the country's interim president, Delcy Rodriguez. But we have been able to speak with some people in Caracas, people like Rafael Bravo. He's a long-term leftist activist and was a supporter of the deposed president. He's uncertain about the country's new leader.
¿Qué va a pasar? ¿Cambiará las políticas?
What will happen? Will Delcy Rodriguez change policies? Will she allow herself to be manipulated or drawn into negotiations that gradually undermine the president's legacy, the socialist legacy?
Ana Rodriguez is definitely not a Maduro supporter. She believes his regime propped itself up through lies, and she doesn't see Delcy Rodriguez lasting long as president.
I honestly think that this is temporary, something done perhaps for there to be a peaceful transition.
Ana Rodriguez believes the exiled opposition leader, Maria Corina Machado, who's been sidelined by the White House, would win a free election.
I think that if there are new elections, which is what is being encouraged, obviously she will be a candidate, and obviously she will be the president of Venezuela.
But right now, that's a very big if. This is Ben Knight in Washington reporting for AM.
Well, the United States has been clear from the outset that access to Venezuela's oil reserves, the largest in the world, has been a major goal of its operation in Venezuela. The president has promised that oil companies will begin to ramp up production of oil within 18 months. But analysts say his plan, which will require billions of dollars over decades, won't be easily realised. Here's Bridget Fitzgerald.
Venezuela has more oil than any other nation on earth, but it extracts just a fraction of the available resource.
Reserves aren't what's most important. What matters is how much oil they can actually get out of the ground and deliver.
Saul Kavanick is the head of energy research at MST Financial.
Over time, Venezuela's exports could grow or even triple from their prevailing rates this year. And that could see Venezuela approach 2 to 3% of global supply compared to if Venezuela remains under sanctions and relatively isolated in the market as they have been over the last 5 to 10 years.
US President Donald Trump has announced interim authorities in Venezuela have agreed to provide at least 30 million barrels of oil to the United States at market price. He's also vowed to ramp up oil production, promising oil companies will begin to invest in Venezuela within 18 months. But there's yet to be any confirmation from the oil companies themselves. The plan would require businesses like ExxonMobil and ConocoPhillips to re-establish operations in Venezuela. Both companies left the country almost 20 years ago after failed negotiations with the government. And convincing these companies to invest billions of dollars won't be easy. Bob McNally is the founder and president of Washington-based energy consultancy Rapidan Energy Group and a former energy advisor to the Bush administration.
Oil companies looking at Venezuela are like a family that's looking at buying a house they're going to live in forever. Not planning a quick vacation. This is not a quick expenditure on a lark.
Venezuela produces heavy crude oil used for things like diesel and asphalt. Bob McNally says it's difficult and expensive to extract.
There are huge pumps that are required to push out this molasses-like crude. Okay, those pumps are probably broken. They need to be repaired and replaced. Diluent, the molasses has to be mixed with lighter liquids like naphtha to make it transportable, to make the oil flow like a liquid. You have to get that, more of it, bringing more of it in. Ports have to be expanded. Pipelines have to be expanded. There's just a whole soup to nuts sort of a supply chain that is required to scale up Venezuelan production back to where it used to be. And that's measured in years to decades and tens of billions of dollars.
And the key to securing that investment will be political stability.
They'll want to know that their investment will be safe after the end of the second Trump term. Because for them, the second Trump term is almost over. That's like tomorrow for an oil company. They want to make sure they know what the government is in Caracas, if it's stable, and if the political environment will be supportive in the coming years to decades. That's how oil companies think.
But if the US plan for Venezuelan oil can be realized, Saul Kavanagh says it should flow on to consumers eventually.
Now, that's not likely to materialize until 2027 at the earliest, but it will certainly be one factor that could help provide ultimately price relief at the pump for Australians at home over the medium term.
There are reports representatives from Exxon, Chevron and ConocoPhillips are expected to meet with White House officials on Friday.
Bridget Fitzgerald reporting. As the Prime Minister faces pressure to call a Commonwealth Royal Commission into the Bondi terror attack, behind the scenes, discussions are continuing as to what form such an inquiry would take. Political reporter Romy Stevens joins me here in the Parliament House studio. Romy, there are a few names being touted as potentials to lead such an inquiry.
Yeah, so both the Australian and Nine newspapers are reporting that former High Court Justice Virginia Bell could potentially lead a Commonwealth Royal Commission if it goes ahead. She served as a judge of the High Court for more than a decade, and she also previously led an inquiry into former Prime Minister Scott Morrison's multiple ministry scandal. Now, it remains uncertain if the Jewish community would be supportive of that appointment. There's also speculation in the press today, some other names being thrown around as potential royal commissioners. That includes the former boss of ASIO, Dennis Richardson. We know that he's also leading the government's inquiry into intelligence and law enforcement agencies. And another name is Federal Court Judge Michael Lee. He presided over the defamation case brought against Channel 10 by Bruce Lerman. So a lot of names being touted, but the Prime Minister is yet to announce a Commonwealth Royal Commission, so a lot of discussions still being had.
Yeah, and is there any more hints on when or if any such announcements will be made?
It still remains up in the air at this stage, despite the Prime Minister softening his language earlier this week when asked if he remained open to a Commonwealth Royal Commission and to that idea. He said that he was having discussions with New South Wales to ensure that the state had everything that it required. And as part of those discussions, they were also talking about how a state royal commission would operate. So in using that language, the Prime Minister didn't rule out a Commonwealth Royal Commission. Labor sources have also said they believe that Anthony Albanese's openness to a Royal Commission is genuine. But whilst the call is yet to be made, the pressure continues to mount.
Political reporter Romy Stevens there. While yesterday's monthly inflation figures were slightly better than expected, prices are still rising faster than the Reserve Bank would like. And that's prompting some economists to warn interest rate hikes could be on the cards for the months ahead. But it's not just homeowners feeling the pain. Political reporter Samantha Dick reports.
With the latest monthly inflation figures keeping the chance of another interest rate hike in play, independent economist Saul Eslake says Australian homeowners are still on the hook.
A majority of economists are anticipating that the Reserve Bank will be lifting interest rates at some point during the year in order to push inflation back to within its 2 to 3% target band.
Consumer price index figures released by the Australian Bureau of Statistics show one of the largest contributors to annual inflation in November was housing, up 5.2%. Shane Oliver, chief economist at AMP, says that includes the costs of building a new home, as well as household expenses such as electricity and ongoing rent increases.
So that's something that will probably, I think, concern the Reserve Bank.
Saul Eslake says there are a number of factors driving household costs.
One is the expiry of the electricity rebate schemes that federal and state governments introduced 2 or 3 years ago.
However, it's not all bad news in the area of housing. The ABS data shows housing building approvals surged by more than 20% compared to this time last year. Saul Eslake says that increase is largely due to local governments in New South Wales, Victoria and Queensland signing off on plans to build more apartments.
That was actually the highest number of apartments approved by local governments across the country since sometime in 2018.
Master Builders Chief Executive Danita Warne welcomes the increase in building approvals, but warns there's still a big delay between project approval and finishing construction.
It takes longer to build a home now than it did about 6 or 7 years ago.
She says sluggish completion times of residential buildings are linked to a shortfall of more than 100,000 skilled workers, sending construction costs through the roof.
Yeah, unfortunately, we've seen nearly a 45% increase in the cost of construction of our homes over the past 5 years. Much of that is because of the cost of time delays of not having enough labour.
With homeowners awaiting a verdict on interest rates, Shane Oliver says they'll have a clearer indication by the end of January.
Ultimately, we've got to wait for the December quarter inflation numbers when they come out at the end of the month, because the Reserve Bank still regards the quarterly numbers as the gold standard.
That's Shane Oliver, Chief Economist at AMP, ending Samantha Dick's report. Well, Melbourne's central thoroughfare, Swanston Street, is currently substituting for New York as Hollywood filmmakers descend on the city. Some experts, though, are worried that taxpayer dollars aren't benefiting homegrown content. Kimberly Price reports.
The bustling street outside Melbourne's town hall turns into New York City as Hollywood heavyweights Gerard Butler and Hayley Atwell shoot their latest film, Empire City. It's a surprise to those who don't know a movie is being filmed.
There's like a massive crane with these massive lights on it, so looking up and seeing that, you're like, that's definitely not normal.
The trash bags are the biggest giveaway, because that's just, no one here would do that.
The film sees Gerard Butler take on the role of a firefighter dealing with a hostage crisis in New York. The Victorian government says the 10-week shoot is creating more than 1,200 jobs and is expected to inject more than $35 million into the state's economy. However, those passing by wish the blockbuster was set locally.
It is a little sad that it's not just like a movie that's set in Melbourne. It has to be this New York-orientated thing.
I think, yeah, it's like, in my head, it's like, it's filming in New York, but it's actually in Melbourne. Are people going to know it's Melbourne?
Writer and film critic Eliza Jansen says Australian cities can easily stand in for American locations.
Melbourne is often cast as New York, Chicago, Seattle, any kind of city that's not so sunny, and then Sydney often subs in for LA.
While many of the big names in Empire City are not locals, Eliza Jansen believes Hollywood productions filmed here can have a massive impact on Australian careers.
Jacob Elordi, one of his first roles was in a Pirates of the Caribbean movie that would have been filming here. It's obviously a boon as well to some of the behind-the-scenes personnel and the production teams to cut their teeth on a bigger production.
During the COVID pandemic, the federal government offered production companies up to 30% tax rebates to film projects here. Jean Tunney, the director of consultant firm Adept Economics, says the generous incentive is bringing more films to Australia, but it may not be benefiting us.
The issue is whether, you know, this is a good use of taxpayer funds or not. It's not clear that this is delivering, you know, value for money for Australia.
Jean Tunney says economists are concerned the tax offsets end up in the hands of foreign production companies rather than with Australian content makers.
I mean, I really do wonder what the benefit to Victoria, a highly indebted state, is of a film that is telling a story about a hostage crisis in New York City. It's rather extraordinary. Now, maybe if it's Australian content and we're telling stories about Australia, that's of high value.
Vic Screen and Oz Film were approached for comment.
Kimberly Price reporting there. An Australian retailer that sells children's toys has been handed a $14 million fine for failing safety standards around potentially fatal button batteries. As Ted O'Connor reports, overseas online stores have also been on notice for selling faulty products.
At this shopping centre in Warrnambool in southwest Victoria, the threat from button batteries can be easily overlooked by parents like these.
Yes, I have a 3-year-old who's into all those toys. I haven't been overly cautious of it in terms of looking.
Well, we know that they're there, but I suppose we don't really check that they're like secure as much, even in their shoes and things like that, when they have flashing shoes.
Others, like mum Chloe Williams, are all too mindful about the risk.
Having 2 young kids under 5, just make sure that obviously they're secured in really well. So if they do have those button batteries, making sure it's like a screw that obviously the kids can't get undone or can't accidentally come undone.
Manufacturers are supposed to make sure button batteries, which look like coins, are well secured.
It's a see.
That means a tool is needed to remove them and screws stay attached to the compartment door.
Anything that lights up, anything that flashes, anything that makes a noise could have a button battery. Now, this is like having a loaded gun in your lounge room.
That's the CEO of KidSafe Queensland, Susan Teards. Last month, Australian retailer City Beach was fined $14 million in the federal court for selling tens of thousands of products that don't meet button battery safety standards, following an investigation by the ACCC. The toys include unicorn key rings and light-up accessories for Crocs shoes. City Beach's recall notice says the button batteries aren't adequately secured and don't include a mandatory warning. Nationally, about 20 children a week attend emergency departments due to concerns over button batteries, and there's been a handful of deaths.
So the little batteries with enough charge poked up the nose or inner ear can actually burn through the septum of the nose and burn into the eardrum. If they're swallowed, then they're most likely in a small child to get stuck because of the shape of the esophagus, the size of the battery, the combination of both. Once that battery stops moving, it will basically turn on and burn a hole through the esophagus. It can burn a hole through to the spine.
Child safety and health advocates are also worried about shonky products from overseas. The consumer group Choice recently bought a few dozen toys from online retailers, including AliExpress, eBay and Amazon. Most didn't meet safety standards to do with button batteries. Susan Teards again.
People in this country assume that we've got so many rules and regulations. There's somebody standing at the border checking everything that comes in. We're a very safe country. But that's not true. It's actually not illegal to sell you an unsafe product. That is a major problem we've got with the consumer laws in this country. And if you're going to buy a product online, don't think for a minute that it's going to meet our Australian standard.
That's the CEO of KidSafe Queensland, Susan Teards, ending that report by Ted O'Connor. And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm David Lipson.